Michael, I'm an alcoholic.
And my mind.
Set aside prayer. Dear God, please set aside anything I think I know about myself, my illness, about the big book, the 12 steps, the program, the fellowship, the people in the fellowship, and all spiritual terms, especially you, God, so that I might have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. Please help me to see the truth. Amen.
Amen. Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Steve C. from Hampton, New Jersey.
My name is Steve and I'm an alcoholic. And here I am, by the grace of God. Teresa, thank you for asking me to speak. It's good to see you again. It's good to see you, Brian. I had the privilege of hearing Brian speak recently over in New Jersey. I called Teresa and asked her for some speakers and asked her specifically to speak. And she said, I'll get you a couple speakers. And you know, I learned that lesson a few years back from this woman who I'd asked to speak at a meeting. And she said, no, I can't speak tonight. I have GSR or whatever it was. It was kind of last minute. But she said, but give me 20 minutes, I'll call you back. And within 20 minutes, she had a speaker for our meeting. And to me, that kind of blew my mind, because anytime I'd been asked to speak and I couldn't, I would say no, and I would hang up the phone. And this woman went the extra mile to make sure I had a speaker that night. And that was a lesson for me. You know, like, we can go the extra mile. We can say no, but also help you find somebody to fill that. And the extra mile, it's a lonely road. There's no traffic. Jump on it. You know, it's little things like that I look out for today in my recovery, of how I could be of service to somebody else, regardless if it's me or if it's somebody else. And I appreciate that. You know, I appreciate that. And Brian had a great message, and Nick had a great message, and it was a great meeting. You know, I just celebrated 6 years. My sobriety date is January 26, 2018. And I have my mother here today. She's not one of us, but she's a big part of my life. You know, and I'll talk a little bit about her and what she's done for me throughout my recovery, and you know, some of the people I've met along the way. But before I got to the rooms, you know, it was a big struggle for me. You know, I was an everyday guy. You know, from the moment I woke up, in between taking a piss and brushing my teeth, I was getting loaded for the day, and I stayed loaded for the day, and that was my life for a very long time. And I hit it pretty well. I hit it until 28, 29, really, when I went into my first rehab, you know, and I didn't even have the courage to tell my family and friends. You know, I had my wife do that for me as I went into the rehab, because I was just so embarrassed. You know, I was so embarrassed that I could not kick this thing on my own. And for years prior to that, leading up to that point, you know, I tried hard. I mean, I tried every which way possible to stop or moderate. I just couldn't do it. You know, it was to the point where I was shackled. You know, it was the bondage all day, every day. Like, I was gonna lie, cheat, steal, manipulate, con, deceive, and do what I had to do in order to get where I had to get and go where I had to go. And if you were in my way, it didn't matter. I was gonna run right over you. You know, for a while, and I'm not proud of it, but people were a means to an end for me. You know, like, if I was associating with you, I probably needed something from you. And, you know, that's where it brought me. It brought me to this low-life human being that I was. And again, that was my life, 24/7 from the moment I woke up. And it was absolutely miserable. You know, it worked. In the beginning, it worked. And there was a time a few years after I started that it just stopped working. And by that time, it was just too late. You know, I was beyond the aid. So going into my first rehab, you know, I get to this rehab and I'm looking around the room and I'm like, man, I'm not like these people. You know, I'm nothing like you guys. You know, the guy I was bunking next to, he had gotten stabbed in the foot. You know, it was this gross ass gouge that he had in his foot, and he's rebandaging it every day, and half the people there were living on the street. And I'm like, I'm not like these guys. You know, like I went into my first rehab and I still had my job. By the time I was 27, my house was paid off. My cars were paid off. I had enough expendable income to do pretty much whatever I wanted to. Not that I was a millionaire. I'm not bragging. I'm just saying. It means nothing. All that material stuff meant absolutely nothing to me. So I'm in this rehab and I'm like, I'm not like these people. I've never been arrested. I still have a wife. I still have a job. I still have a car. I still have a house. I still have all the stuff. And I got out of that rehab, and I remember my 30th birthday down in AC, I got annihilated, you know, because I figured, all right, well, I stopped for a month. I'm good now. I got annihilated drunk, and I was back off to the races again, you know, and many more years later of rehabs and treatment centers and detoxes and halfway houses and sober houses. You know, I spent about 9 months of my life in inpatient treatment centers, another two and a half years in sober living houses. And, you know, I just couldn't stop. Anytime I would stop, whether it was a day or a week or a month, that obsession was just with me like white on rice, you know, 24/7. Like I had to. There was no fighting that urge, you know, like compulsive to the max, to the absolute max. I was just so uncomfortable. I had a sponsee once who told me, you know, to drink is to die. And then he flipped it and he goes, I felt to not drink was to die. And I was like, wow, that is a perfect way to put it, you know, because that's how I felt. To not drink was to die. Like, I just did not feel like a human being unless I had something. Unless I had something in my body. And it was a struggle. You know, it was a struggle for many years. And I hurt a lot of people. I hurt my family members. I hurt my friends. You know, I used everybody to try to get to where I needed to go. And I was able to put together a month or 3 months. And every single time I would go back out. You know, I was introduced to AA at 29. And I hated it. I hated everything about it. I hated the people. I thought this was stupid. That was stupid. I thought everything about it was dumb. It sounded so trivial. It made no sense to me how this is going to save my life. You know, like I got some serious problems. Those don't look like serious solutions. And that was my mentality, you know, and I was not with the God thing. I thought that was way too religious for me. And, you know, I just floundered in and out, back and forth, back and forth. And I got a million stories, right? But it was just hell. The best way I can describe it is one word, hopeless. You know, to the point where I was suicidal. I didn't want to live. I knew I was going to die from this disease. There was no doubt in my mind. Every fiber in my being said, you will never beat this thing. You're never going to make it. And I just went about my life that way, knowing that, all right, I'm just going to be a statistic. It's only a matter of time. And it was miserable. It was absolutely miserable. Miserable. So some things happen, right? And I believe through this work, we reach a spiritual experience. But I think in my experience, something has to happen before that. Something has to happen to where you want to do this work. And for me, it was having 2 years abstinent and not working a program, going to like a meeting or two a week, showing face, meeting people, having fun, yucking it up before and after the meeting, and just having these friends, you know, and I never took any suggestions. So having 2 years abstinent, you know, one night, I just got a phone call. I got a phone call from a guy I used to deal with, and he said, I got some stuff. I said, okay, let's do it. You know, and I left work that day and I'm driving to go meet this guy. And the whole ride there, I'm like, this is not going to be good. 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 And the whole ride home, this is not going to be good. This is not going to be good. Like, that was my true introduction to powerless. Powerless. Like, I knew I was powerless, but I've never felt powerless on that level where I knew exactly where this is going to take me. I knew it was going to be bad, but I could not say no. And I get home that night, and I'm finally living back in my house at the time. And I get home and I go upstairs and I lock myself in the bathroom. And my little girl, who's 5 at the time, my wife were downstairs, and I did what I did. And I immediately fell out and I hit the floor. And from downstairs, my 5-year-old and my wife heard me hit the floor. And they came up, the bathroom door was locked. My wife had to literally kick the door down to get to me. And there I was on the floor, convulsing with blood coming out of my mouth. And for the first time ever, that little girl got to see the effects of this disease on her father. And all I remember 20 minutes later, as the ambulance finally got there, was the screams and cries of that little girl as I'm getting carted off on a stretcher, screaming, "I want my daddy, I want my daddy." You know, in a voice that I never want to hear ever again. You know, just pure terror. Pure absolute terror. That little girl, my wife did a beautiful job of sheltering that girl from her father when he was active. And she got to finally see what this disease does to people. And something happened. You know, something happened. I realized that night, like, I'm supposed to be this kid's protector, her caretaker. I ain't supposed to hurt her. I'm her father. And that night, something hit me. Something hit me really hard. And I got to the hospital, and I should not be alive today. You know, my heart rate was still over 200 when I got to the hospital that night. And I remember this guy, he was like kind of like a interventionist, you know, hired by the hospital. He was a member of AA. And he came there, and we sat, we talked for like a half an hour. And, you know, that guy stayed in touch with me after that for the next couple of months, make sure I was okay. But, you know, my wife kicked me out of the house again, and the next morning, I'm talking to my wife on the phone, and she's like, "You don't remember what your daughter said to you yesterday on the day you picked up?" And I had to think about it. And when I was getting ready for work that morning that I picked up at 7 a.m., my little girl is sitting at her arts and crafts table, and she's praying. And she's saying, "God, please don't let my dad go to heaven. Please don't let my dad go to heaven." The only thing I could think of, right, is a couple months prior to that, my in-law's dog passed away, and that was the first experience my daughter had with death, of something that she really loved. And she knew that dog wasn't coming back. And we had to explain to that little kid where the dogs go. Dogs go to heaven, right? You ain't gonna see that dog ever again. And my daughter decided she wants to see her dad. She knows if dad goes to heaven, she ain't gonna see him again. And that morning she decided to pray for me. You know, we're not a religious household. You know, I personally don't go to church. My wife will go once a year for the Easter thing, right? But you know, something happened in that moment too. You know, I had this little window of willingness to believe that something's out there watching over me, because I shouldn't be alive. You know, I should have been dead. And that opened up everything for me. Everything, you know, and I felt a level of empathy that day that I had never felt my entire life. And hearing people's stories in the rooms, I've heard a lot of stories like mine where something happens, some interaction happens with another human being to the point where they finally see what they're doing. Their moment of clarity, right? Like I saw, felt, and heard in that moment what I was doing. What I did to that little girl, I saw truth. I saw the harm I was doing. Not that I couldn't necessarily see it before, but this was black and white. I mean, it was there. It was very profound. And I knew. And for a guy like me who was plagued with the obsession, every time I put a drink down, it was gone. I knew it. There were times in the past where I thought, all right, this might be the time. this might be the time that I stop. There was not one doubt in my mind. I was done. I had been lifted up by something. I didn't know what, but it was something. You know, today I call that God, you know, in that 9-step promises. It doesn't have to happen in the 9th step. We'll suddenly realize that something is doing for me what I can't do for myself. That was my moment. And ever since then, I've been running with it. You know, I had a passion for it. You know, I have a passion for the program. I have a passion for AA and helping people. Because I know what kind of a gift I got. And I want to try to give it away. Even though I know I'm not capable of giving it to you, I could try to help you get there. And it's just been an awesome journey, right? So I'm going to talk about some stories from my journey, because recovery has been just amazing. Absolutely amazing. There's a story in the book called The Independent Blonde. I don't know if you guys ever read it. It's one of my favorite stories. On the last page, she talks about going on a 12-step call. And the guy asks her, do you have 90 days? And she said, no. And he said, well, you can't go. You're not qualified yet. And what she realized was she had nothing to give yet. What she also realized was what she was getting from these people was compassion. And as soon as she got that compassion, she was able to give it away. But she hadn't learned that yet. That's me to a T. You know, I can actually have compassion for other people today. For me, my experience is that happened through the steps. You know, I had my moment of clarity. I had my awakening. I had my came to believe moment before the steps happened. The steps just blew it up for me. Like, absolutely blew it up to a whole nother level. And, you know, my step 1, 2, and 3, to me, that was that moment. That was that gift. You know, I was ready. I was ready to change. I was ready to give up. I was ready to do something different. I was ready to take direction, you know, and follow suggestions from other people. Something I had never done before. Ask for help. Something I had never done before. I actually remember going up to a guy and being like, yo, can you help me? He's like, yeah, absolutely. I can help you. You know, nobody asks for help. It's a tough thing to do. And, my inventory journey has been absolutely amazing. I think I shared my biggest one in Doylestown was with my biological father. You know, I had a massive resentment towards my biological father because I thought he abandoned me. I thought he just left us. He didn't care about us, any of that stuff. And I had this feeling of abandonment for a long time, you know, and I was pissed about it. It's like, why? Like, why would you do that? If you're a father, why would you just kind of let your kid be like that? And, you know, my parents got divorced when I was 2 years old. And I saw my father a couple times after that. Not much at all. And I rarely talked to him. And occasionally he would send me something for Christmas. And that was about it. And the last time I saw him was when I was 17. And I saw him in a casket when he died. And me and my mom and my sister, we took the trip up to Saratoga, and I got to talking to some of his friends, and some of his friends didn't even know he had kids. Like, I was introducing myself to them, and they're like, oh, you're Mike's son. Like, I didn't even know he had a son. And I'm getting more and more pissed off at this funeral. Like, man, he doesn't even talk about his kids. Like, this is crazy, you know? And there was a little boy. There was a little boy who spoke at his funeral, and he was up there and he was crying, and he was talking about how much of a father my dad was to him, and how they used to spend all this time together and go fishing and do this stuff, and I'm just getting more pissed by the second, you know, like, man, what a complete scumbag, you know. And you know, when I started doing inventory, that was one of the things on my resentment list. And the first time I did inventory, we got to the fourth column, and it's like, what's my mistake in this relationship? And I honestly couldn't find a mistake that I made. I really couldn't. The only one, there was one, and that was I never reached out to him. And I'm just holding on to this resentment, and I will not forgive. The second time I did inventory, I started seeing a little bit more. And what I started seeing was, I'm just like this man. You know, my biological father loved fishing more than his family. That's why my parents got divorced. because he loved fishing more than his family. And when I look at my life, in the first 5 years of my daughter's life, I loved booze more than I did my own kid. And that's a fact. I showed that in my actions. I would never say that. In my heart, I love my kid more than anything. But in reality is, the way I acted and what I did on a daily basis showed that I loved alcohol more than I did my kid. And I was like, wow, like, holy crap. And for a minute, I had some compassion for this man, you know? And then I started the what ifs, you know? Like, what if my wife, through my alcoholism, divorced me, took the kids, left, went 3 hours away, got remarried? Would I be able, am I a big enough man to go now visit my kids while now my wife is married to some other guy who's technically raising my kids on a daily basis? I don't know. I would like to think I would, but I don't know. I've never been in that situation. So I started having a little bit more compassion for this man. And then I was like, if I never visited my kids or had no plan to go visit them after we got divorced, would I even tell my friends that we had kids and then face that? Face your friends asking you, why aren't you visiting your kids? I'm like, it's an easier, softer way just to say, I don't even have kids, so you don't even get questioned about it. And then I got to a point where I was like, man, you know, I like helping people today. It's a beautiful thing. I was talking to my mom about it on the way up here. Like, it is, it's cool, man. I love it. It gives me purpose. He helped that little kid. He made such an impact on that little kid's life to the point where that kid was crying at his funeral. So now I'm looking at it like, that's commendable. You know, that's a good man. Maybe that was his redemption for what he didn't do with his own kids, you know, making up for it by helping somebody else out. And now I'm sitting here like, wow, my dad's he's a pretty good dude, you know what I mean? So you go from hating this guy to actually looking at him like, you made a positive impact in somebody's life. That's an awesome thing. And it was only through inventory that I got there. Complete forgiveness for my father. Like, if he walked in here today, I would say, I'm proud of you. I'm proud of you for what you did to that kid, you know? Not only that, my stepfather, who I call my father, treats her like a queen. You know, that doesn't happen if my biological father's still in the picture, because he wasn't treating anybody like a queen. So there's a gift in that too, you know? And now I can look back through my life and say, yeah, my father, my stepfather, who I call my father, was an amazing dad, you know? But I was just so blinded by what my biological father was not doing for me that I wasn't even recognizing what he was doing for me, you know, which is being a supportive dad, showing up to all my games, putting a roof over our head, food on the table, supported me no matter what, loved me like one of his own, you know, which is amazing. So that's like my alcoholic mind. It always wants to find the negative and just hold it and hold it and hold it, and be a victim, and be a victim, and hold the negative. And that's shown up through sobriety for me. You know, things that I've seen in my 10th step, you know, outside of my 4th step. Just that same kind of pattern, you know. Like, give you an example, like, my dad went and took a Narcan class. I had a problem with opiates, too. You know, I was everything. I was a garbage head. And, you know, my wife's telling me that my dad went and took a Narcan class, and she's like, that's so not like your dad to go do that. You know, that's like out of character. And my immediate thought was, he has no faith in me. He has zero faith in me. And my wife looks at me and she's like, that's love. That's love that he would go do that. And I was like, wow, maybe it is love. You know, like, never looked at it that way. So I'm like, all right, tiebreaker, I'll call my sponsor. And I called my sponsor, and I was like, what do you think of this whole situation? And I lay it out to him, and he said, that's love. And I was like, god damn, it is love. I guess we're going to go with love, right? And a couple days later, I find out that, you know, in the city my dad works in, by law, he has to take a Narcan class. So it actually had nothing to do with me. It was nothing to do with me, which is more my dad. You know what I mean? Does my dad love me? Yeah, absolutely. Would he go take a Narcan class for me? No, he would not. It's like half full, half empty, but then there's also 4 ounces. Sometimes it's just 4 ounces. You know what I mean? Depending on what the facts are. And that's another thing that AA has taught me is to find the facts. You know, it's a fact-finding mission at all times. You know, it's like, what's the truth in this? How do I find the truth? Yeah, I had some really good amends story, right? This sober living house that I lived in Bethlehem, PA, I was there for about 2 years, and I was not well pretty much the whole time I was there. And I stole money from this place multiple times. I'm sorry, I borrowed money, and I got caught borrowing money multiple times. I had a sponsee tell me that. We were going through our 4-step, right? And I said, have you ever stolen from anybody? He's like, nah, but. He's like, I used to borrow money from my work. And then I'd put it back the next day. I'm like, yeah, that's called stealing. Just because you don't get caught doesn't mean it's not stealing. You know, there's criteria. It's like if it's not yours and you walk out the door with it, that's called stealing. Yeah, well, I thought I was laughing at him and he didn't sound too amused by it. But I was like, yeah, I thought the same thing. I was borrowing money from this Oxford house until I wasn't, you know, until the cops got called. So I borrowed money and got caught multiple times at this Oxford house, and the last time was like $2,000. You know, I was like a treasurer at the house and I was cooking the books, and cops were called, charges were not pressed. I paid the money back a few months later, gave everybody in the house, paid for an extra week of their rent, and apologized to the guys at the time. Well, a few years later when I was doing like formal amends, I went back and I sat down and did some verbal amends with these guys, you know, and talked to them. And one of the guys brought up something that was very profound for me, which I never thought of, you know, which was, he goes, Steve, we liked you. You know, we thought you were a half decent guy. And he goes, you have no idea how much I struggle with having to call the cops at night. He said, I didn't want to be that guy. He's like, I know you got a family and you got kids. I don't want to be the guy to make that call. He goes, I would feel like a giant. He goes, I called the cops and I was praying they wouldn't take you to jail because I didn't want to be that guy. And I'm sitting there listening to this guy. I'm like, I never thought about that. Not once did I ever think like how this affected him mentally and emotionally. You know, I always just thought, all right, I pissed you off because I took your money. I didn't know how deep it went. And I was like, wow, that's a pretty good insight, you know. And I remember a few years later, my boss at work, man, I don't like this guy, right? So I did not like this guy. He's kind of a narcissist. Just kind of does whatever he does. He's real shady, kind of like me back in the day. He's very much like me, which is probably why I didn't like him. You know, always trying to get away with something, committing fraud, trying to cover up mistakes that he made. And this one mistake that he made was a pretty big mistake. It was like a $25,000 mistake that he was trying to cover up. Like he was like, he got rid of some product. Now he's like making up labels and putting it on different product to make it look like it was that product. And they have this whole big investigation going. And I know exactly what he did and how he did it. And I didn't want to know the facts, you know? And these people were investigating and they're coming up and they're asking people questions. And I'm having this anxiety attack, right? And there's a part of my brain that's going, you know, if you tell them this guy's getting fired, you won't have to deal with him ever again. He'll be gone. You'll probably get a raise. You'll probably get his position, promotion, the whole nine. Like, it's a win-win, win-win-win all around when you think about it. But there's this big part of me that's like, I can't do that. Like, I'm trying to live differently today. You know, me 10 years ago, it's a no-brainer. This guy's gone. I'm ratting him out in 2 seconds. And for whatever reason, you know, I'm getting this anxiety and I'm feeling this anxiety attack. And all I could think about was Brian at the Oxford house, making that amends. and hearing him say, I didn't want to be the one to make that decision. And your family and your kids. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, this guy's got a family. This guy's got kids. Like, if I do this, what's he putting on his resume going forward? You know, does his kids deserve the dad not being able to work and support the family? And then I'm like, you know how many chances I got? Like, an insane amount of chances. And I just left work. You know, I couldn't, I didn't want to be put in that position. You know, and had I not made that amends to Brian, I don't think it would have been, I don't know how it would have turned out. But because of him and getting that input in that amends, right? Getting that feedback that usually we don't want to hear, but it's the best feedback you can hear because it's truth. It's truth, it's real, it's packed with emotion. That's the consequences of this disease, you know? How I look at the ninth step, it's like I'm sitting down with these people and I'm hearing, you're giving them a chance to talk and they're telling you some truth and you're hearing the true consequences of your disease. It's not what happens to you. Those are the self-centered consequences. It's what we do to the other people, unwillingly. I remember sitting down with my mom. My mom actually taught me a good amends lesson. And the lesson was, hey, tell them your purpose before you go over there. I text my mom, like, can I come over tomorrow morning? I need to talk to you. She's like, yeah, it's fine. I come over, I sit down with my mom, my dad, and I make my amends. And, you know, I got some good feedback. I got some really tough feedback to hear, but I need to hear it. You know, my dad, who's not emotional really at all, who doesn't really open up that much, you know, saying, you know, like, I was losing sleep over you. We didn't know what to do with you. You know, that one rehab you left and you called your brother to come pick you up from, and we had to call him and say, don't go pick up your brother. Like, that was a tough decision for us to make. Like, we didn't want to do that. We had no idea what to do with you. We didn't know if we were going to hurt you or help you. And that was a big one for me. It's like, wow, like, I never thought about that either. People were so afraid to come up to me and mention anything to me because they didn't know if it was going to send me over the edge or if it was going to help me. Or maybe it wasn't going to do anything. They just, they had no idea. And after that amends, my mom's like, yeah, we were hoping you were coming over to make the amends, but we didn't know. We thought maybe this could be just another bomb you're going to drop on us or something. So, yeah, my mom taught me anytime you make amends, tell them your purpose of the visit before you go over there so they're not worried about you, you know, so they know what you're coming over for. My brother-in-law, you know, he's a good dude, you know, and I could not think of like an instance, right, when I'm doing this, making a list of where I like hurt him directly, other than I just wasn't around to be there for him, you know? And I was racking my brain for months and months and months trying to figure out, like, there's gotta be something in there that I can go make amends for other than just like some vague stuff, you know? And I couldn't come up with anything. And there was one point where he was struggling with a breakup and he was having like kind of like a psychotic break, you know, and he was really getting to the point where he was kind of suicidal and just all over the place. And he was over the house one day. I told him to come over because he was struggling and we're talking. And then all of a sudden he's like, I got to talk to you. And it got like really serious and really heavy really quick. I'm like, all right, yeah, shoot, what you got? And he's like, you know, I was told I need to talk to you by his girlfriend. And he goes, I need to tell you that during your daughter's party when she was about 2 years old, I believe, and you were passed out on the couch, all messed up, and Vivian, my daughter, trying to come up to me and wake me up on the couch, and I wouldn't wake up because I was just so polluted. He goes, I wanted to kill you. I literally wanted to kill you. And when I tell you I have not felt rage transmitted in such a non-violent way before, that's what I felt. Like I could see it in his eyes. I could feel it. It was palpable. And he goes, and I went home and my dog crapped all over the house. He said, I beat that dog, wanting it to be you. You know, he goes, I wanted to kill you. So I made my amends that night, you know, and it was powerful. You know, I was a topic of conversation with my brother and his girlfriend. And this was years ago, you know, and they were talking about it recently. I was a topic of conversation, and I had no recollection of that day whatsoever. You know, when I tell you I have no recollection, I mean it. Like, when he was talking about that, I couldn't even remember it. I'm sure it happened, but I couldn't remember it. And that was another lesson that amends taught me was, I have no idea who I hurt. I have no idea. Because if I can't remember that, God knows how many other people I can't remember. You know, so my list got a lot longer that day. A lot longer. And, you know, there was another guy. There was a guy who I lived in one of his sober houses right outside of East Stroudsburg. And I dipped out on the last month's rent in that sober house. And whatever it was, 6-7 years later, I went back to go make an amends to this guy. And I didn't like this guy. You know, I thought he kind of used me for cheap labor. I would do stuff around his houses, and he would kind of nickel and dime me for how many hours I worked and whatnot. So I thought, like, not paying rent the last month was kind of justified. You know, like, he tried to get over on me, I tried to get over on him, the whole nine. So I go back there, and I don't really... First, I was trying to find this guy. I couldn't find him. Couldn't find his number. I told my sponsor that I was just going to donate the money to some charity. He said, no, keep searching. Try Google. So I tried Google, and I found him. Believe it or not, like, one of the first things that popped up was, you know, man offers $10,000 reward for anybody who knows where his money went. Somebody came into his house and stole a safe, which apparently had six figures worth of cash in it. And I was like, wow, that's him. That's Scott. I'm going to go up there and make an amends. So I brought money up there, and I sat down with him. And again, going into it, like, I thought this guy was pulling people out of rehab and just using them for cheap labor and just trying to get one over on them, you know. And I get there, and we're sitting down, and he's got guys working all over his house. And they're all in recovery. You know, this guy's got, at the time, he had like 20 years. And we talked for like 3 hours. I paid him his money back, and, you know, my view on him changed that the whole time I was there, because, again, going into it, I thought this guy was a scumbag. And sitting down and watching him interact with all these people in recovery, giving them all jobs, you know, and he told me stories about when he first came out of rehab years ago, how somebody grabbed him and gave him a job and gave him a chance. And gave a lot of people a lot of chances. And the guy that robbed him was actually in recovery, you know? And he had all these sober houses where people like me would dip out on rent, steal the TV off the wall, trash the place. Like, he wasn't making any money. He wasn't making any money housing people, and he wasn't making any money hiring people because they did a terrible job. He would have been much better just hiring a contractor. But my view on him changed that day because I saw a guy who just wanted to help people. He just wanted to give people a chance, you know, which is, again, that's commendable stuff, especially when these people are just screwing you left and right. So that was a very good amends for me to see, you know, just a different perspective on people. And, when I started adventuring into, you know, 10 to 11, a few years ago, I was speaking at a meeting in Trenton, and this guy came up to me and he goes, will you be my 11th step buddy? I said, yeah, sure. I've never done that, but yeah, well, let's give it a shot, you know? And me and this guy, for 6 months straight, every night, we'd talk on the phone for 15 minutes. And we'd go over those questions on page 86. And what I found in 10 to 11 is you ask yourself different questions, you're going to get different answers. All those questions on that page, like, I had never asked myself before. Like, I had never sat down every day and looked at, like, how I'm treating people. You know, like, what am I contributing to life rather than taking from it? You know, like, where am I being fearful, dishonest, selfish? And I got some really cool things, you know. Like, I started seeing start seeing a whole lot of stuff, a whole lot of good stuff, like seeing my fears crop up and how I want to act on them, right? I'll give you an example. I'm sitting at the table with my wife one night, and I was thinking about moving money around from one stock brokerage to another, a couple different things, and I had this fear come up, and the fear was she was going to say no. All right, so I'm sitting at the table, and I'm trying to get the courage to ask her, and I'm like, what if she says no, then I don't get my way, you know? And I'm sitting there, I'm struggling, I'm looking at her, I'm looking down, I'm looking at her, I'm looking down, and she's like, do you have something to say? And I said, yeah, I was thinking about doing A, B, and C. She's like, yeah, it's fine. I was like, wow, that's like, that's pretty easy, you know? But I make this big deal about it. And I'm sitting down, I'm doing my 11 step that night, and I see the fear, right? And I see the fear, and then I sit there and I think, like, what happens if I succumb to the fear? Every time I succumb to the fear, I practice a defect. 9 times out of 10. And that defect would have been dishonesty. The defect would have been selfishness, one, for not wanting to tell her. But two, I would have been dishonest about it. I just wouldn't have told her. So now I'm looking at two paths. The path I took, which is what you guys taught me, right? To be honest and just speak. Or the path of dishonesty, and where does that lead me? That leads me to all kinds of different places. You know, and doing that every night, I started seeing different things. I started seeing all these fears, and little dishonesties. I remember driving with my wife in the car one day, and I was like, she asked me a question, and I gave her an honest answer, and it was something that I normally probably would have told a little white lie about. Can't remember even what it was. And I was like, man, it's been a while since I've lied. You know, out loud, I'm saying this. And she's like, well, congratulations. Thank you for being a normal friggin' human being for once. Little stories like that, that's kind of been my journey, you know. Over the summer, I was in this really good spiritual place, man. I'm like, I'm going to the store, I'm getting my wife some flowers, I'm getting my kids some treats and whatnot, and I'm like, I don't know, I was just spiritually elevated, I guess, just in a good mood. And I go up to the line, I'm going to check out, and this place is like jumping. They have like nobody checking anybody out. There's like a million people in the store, and we're sitting in lines and we're waiting in lines for forever, whatever. And I'm just tooling around on my phone, checking emails, doing whatever I'm doing. And the guy behind me is just like mother effing the world, right? Just these damn lines and goddamn people and blah, 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 blah. He's got to go somewhere, wherever he's got to go. So we're finally creeping up. And the lady in front of me, he's got this little tiny kid, and this kid's just like beaming, you know what I mean? Like ear to ear smile, happy with life, loving it. So I'm just kind of looking at him, and the guy behind me, he's still going off. And the lady in front of me, eventually we get up to the point where she's about to check out, you know, and this guy's still going. I was like, dude, why don't you just go in front of me? You know, like it's cool. Go in front of me. So he goes in front of me. The lady's checking out. After she gets rung up for all her stuff, she drops down like an envelope of coupons. And the guy's like, oh, they're effing coupons, you know, like cursing up a storm still. And I'm like, this guy, man, what a piece of crap, you know, like this, so impatient, the whole nine. And coupons go through. She reaches in her purse and she pulls out what looks like a EBT card, you know, like food stamps. And she hands it over, the woman swipes it, and she has a balance. And the woman goes back into her purse and she pulls out $40 cash. And the guy who's now in front of me puts his hand on her hand, chops it down, pulls out money, gives it to the cashier. And she goes on her way. She says, thank you very much. And I'm like, looking at this guy, I'm looking at her, and I'm thinking to myself, like, that's the craziest 10 step I've ever seen in my entire life. You know what I mean? Like, here's a guy who's just verbally cursing up a storm audibly, like this woman could hear him complain. And he goes ahead and pays for her stuff. And I was sitting there judging this guy the whole time, like what a piece of crap he is. The whole time in my head, I'm like, this guy, man, will this dude ever shut up, right? Because there was a time where I told that guy to shut up. There was a 100%. And there was also a time where I would not let that guy go in front of me. But for whatever reason, I had a thought that in that moment, let this guy go in front of you. You know, just be useful, be of service, do something. And I did. Now, I don't know if me letting that guy in front of me, if I didn't do that, would he have not paid for this woman's stuff? Would he have not been able to see what I saw, which was maybe a single mom struggling who couldn't afford these groceries? Like, I don't know. I just had a good thought and I acted on it. And I thought about that moment a lot for like the next week. And I'm like, who am I to judge anybody? You know, like, I was that guy. At some point in my life, at a lot of points in my life, I was that guy. Pushing and just trying to go where I need to go and get people out of my way so I could get there faster. Yet I'm also the guy who will pay for your groceries at times. Do you know what I mean? So how do I know what this guy truly is? He could be the best guy in the world. He could be the worst guy in the world. You could meet me on a day where I'm like ready to slash your tires. And then the very next day I might help you change a flat. Do you know what I mean? And it made me realize, like, really looking at that whole situation, like, I don't know anybody. So who am I to judge what kind of character you have? Cool little stories like that. That's been my recovery, you know, slowly learning, like, what's right, what's wrong, what's true, what's false. And actually being able to see things from like a neutral position and not just like completely swing one way of like, this guy's a complete piece of crap. You know, having my eyes open to a different reality. Actually being able to see a forest through some of the trees. And it's been an awesome ride, you know. And one of my favorite things to do today is to help people. AA is kind of like, you guys ever seen The Dog Whisperer? Caesar Milan. Yeah, we're like very similar to dogs, I think. So we come in here, we got these like problem dogs, you know. Everybody's seen them. I think it was Dan, right? Your name's Dan? Yeah, Dan's got some big dogs. I'm sure he's had some problem dogs at some point. And the owners just can't do nothing with them, you know. So they like might bring him to Dan. And Dan's like, dude, your dog's nuts. Like, get this dog out of here. I can't fix it. I don't know who can fix it. And then they finally meet Caesar Milan. You know, he's like the guru. He's the guy with the message of depth and weight. You know, he's armed with the facts. So he comes in as this little alcoholic dog, and Caesar does his thing, and he teaches him how to be proper, you know, teaches him how to be a proper dog. And he does the best he can. But, you know, if you've ever watched the show, there are times where Caesar is outmatched. There are some problem dogs that Caesar just can't handle. And what does he do? He brings him to the pack, the power of the pack. So with his guidance and his trained dogs, his recovered dogs, he brings this alcoholic dog in there and he says, hey, why don't you go interact with these guys? These guys will teach you how to be a proper dog. It's like no more butt sniffing, no more jumping on the tables, no more leg humping, can't crap on the carpet anymore, like none of that stuff. You can't be doing that stuff no more. And what happens? The power of the pack teaches this dog how to live. Teaches this dog how to live proper and live a good life. And that's kind of how AA has been for me. God will show you how to create the fellowship you crave, you know. And my guys, my sponsees today, that's the fellowship I crave. You know, they are my pack. They keep me sober more than I keep them sober, 200%, without a doubt, you know. My mom got to meet some of them the other day, and it's just, it's a gift, man. You know, one of the best gifts I ever got was being able to, one of my sponsees, Jay, being able to work with not only him, but his wife. You know, like when he went away to rehab, I brought my wife, who's been to Al-Anon, over to meet Jay's wife. And that was just an awesome experience, you know, to see my wife participate in their recovery too. You know, and today he's a good dad, he's a good husband, and he's going places. You know, and to me, that's what it's all about. It's all about helping people. Like, how am I helping people? It's not only fun and rewarding. I love it. I can't express enough how much I love it and what these guys do for me. And, you know, even the failures, you know, I was talking to my mom about this too. Like, there's a lot of failures in AA. A lot of bad things happen. You lose a lot of people. A lot of people go out and they do crazy stuff and it's sad. But it's not all bad. You know, if it was all bad, I don't know if I'd be able to do it. But even in the bad, I see some lessons. You know, like I had a guy I was working with, Brian, who was actually a friend of Jim Bonner's. And, you know, this kid, he wasn't ready, you know, and unfortunately he died before he got ready. And I remember going to his funeral and seeing his mom and his family. And I didn't see one tear shed. You know, this guy went to rehab down in Virginia, got kicked out of the rehab, and they found him behind somebody's shed 2 days later dead. You know, what I saw on that woman's face was relief. Absolute relief. Like, man, I can sleep at night. Like, I don't have to worry about where my son is anymore. Which is sad, you know, it's very sad, but it's true. When I saw that, I just kept thinking about my mom, you know. All these things are just reminders as to why I need to keep doing what I'm doing. So as tragic as that may be, it was something I had to see. It was something I had to see, you know. And I had another sponsee that passed a few years ago. And, you know, I got to help his mom. I got to go out to lunch with his mom after he passed. I got to help her clean out his room, you know, because they were going to move to South Carolina since he had passed. And, you know, I got to have an impact in that woman's life in a positive way, you know. It's little things like that why I keep doing what I'm doing and try to help people as much as I can. And I love it. I love working with these guys. These guys teach me so much. I love working with my sponsor. My sponsor is nuts. He's not a big book guy, right? He knows the big book inside and out. He calls himself a recovering big book thumper because he said he'd rather have friends than be people with the big book. He knows it inside and out. But when I first met him and we sat down, I came to his house with the big book. He's like, what are you doing with that? He's like, throw that thing right in the garbage. We're just going to sit down. We're going to talk. He has it all memorized, you know, so it's not like he doesn't follow the program or anything. But, you know, all his stuff was like very on the fly experience, you know. So when I called him with a problem, he would say, oh, yeah, that's here in the big book. What you're talking about is on page so and so in the big book. And he would direct me to that. And he said, that's what they're talking about. Now you have a real life example of what that looks like. And that's kind of how we learn. But I'll wrap it up. We have a minute left. AA saved my life. You know, the people in it have saved my life. What brings people to the point of passion for a change? You know, I can't give. I can't give that. I think drinking gives that to some extent. You know, but when you're finally ready to make a change, we're here for you. There's a lot of people here for you. Again, I can't give that spark, that flame that makes you want to do something different. But I can promise you, if you do something different, good stuff happens. You know, and I wake up in the morning glad to be alive. There was a time where I did not want to wake up or be alive. And there was a time when I thought about drinking 24/7. Today I do not think about it. It's not even on the radar. You understand? There's no decision to be made. There's no choice. In order to have a choice, you got to have options. In order to have options, you got to have a couple different thoughts. There is no thought. It's I give that credit to God and AA 100%. It's none of my own doing. You know, all I had to do was find a couple guys that could show me how to live and do it. And that's been my experience. And that's why I keep coming and try to pass it on to the next guy. With that being said, you know, I'm very grateful to be here today. Teresa, thank you again for asking me to share. And with that, we have a nice way of closing.